instead of we. He said mistakes that we have made. And there's a tendency for Christians to say they did this and they did that. And I think outsiders to Christianity are not fooled by that. These are mistakes that we have made. Daniel had that attitude in Daniel 9. He's praying to God about the reasons they've been taken into captivity. And Daniel had done none of those things. And yet in the prayer, he said, we have sinned against you. And also in Nehemiah, similar situation. Nehemiah, in talking about how the people have been unfaithful, he said, we have been unfaithful. So even as you talk about things like the Crusades, I think saying we instead of they, I think that gives us a lot more credibility. I think it's more honest. And even in the current situation with racism in America, we could say they did this to African Americans. But I think what we should say is we did this. And if we own that, even though we could argue that as a single individual person, you didn't do it, if you say that we did it, I think that's even in that situation, I think it's far superior. Okay, good. We promised to start out with some questions. Do you all feel good about this question about scriptures that could be used to support, you know, sort of a Calvinistic predestination and things, ones that couldn't? I'm going to try to resolve that. This is not a Bible class, and so it's not even a Bible study, but I'm going to do a little mini, tiny bit of Bible study to try to resolve that. I left it in a unsolved situation on purpose. It's just like Jacob's shirt. It says sold out. What's that mean? You know, it's kind of like that. We leave it some doubt, and that's good. All right, so comments about that or questions about what's come up from our study of the history of Christianity. Feel free to open up your mics also if you're in Zoom. Surely some questions were raised here. All right, let's see if you were, in quotes, paying attention. I mentioned a couple of weaknesses that come along with restoration-type Christian movements. Although I'm a part of what could be thought of as a restoration-type Christian movement, and I'm proud of that, I pointed out some potential weaknesses that seem to always crop up. And what can anybody mention one or two of those? I did it in the context of talking about the Anabaptists and even the early Baptists. Yes, go ahead. Right, the tendency to be divisive and to form schisms like almost as soon as the movement forms. And why is it that restoration type groups tend to schism more than other Christian groups?
Just because like they're trying to restore and so trying to hold to something, it causes a lot of people to want to be like, no, it has to be this way.
Right. You're not using the perfect words, but you have the exact concept. So the bottom line is, if we're restoring the true gospel, what is the content of the true gospel? What is essential and what is not? And this is something that we have to be aware of, that if you have a creed defining what you believe and what you teach, you're pretty much good to go. We don't like that. But the alternative is tricky at best and almost always destructive at worst. Okay, what's another problem? Yeah.
Asceticism
is that, yeah, it is true that that's not true of the American English Restoration movement. It's not true, but a number of restorationist type movements have tended to veer too strongly into asceticism. That's certainly true in the Anabaptist movement. Okay. I don't think that's a general thing, though, about restoration movements. Not necessarily. Could be. Something to look for. Okay, I'll give my second. The second answer is they tend to dismiss everybody else as whether they're a Christian or not. And therefore, they tend to be ahistorical. They tend to not only to be schismatic amongst themselves, but they tend to say everybody else who came before us are all going to hell. None of them are saved. And in the process, they perhaps dishonor God, but they become ahistorical. They don't acknowledge their history. And if you don't acknowledge your history, then you can't understand why you do what you do. Okay, so there's some inherent weaknesses in restoration-type philosophy. And when we talk about the Stone Campbell movement, we can ask, was that a restoration or a reformation? And I think the reformation concept might be a wiser concept, possibly, just throw it out there, than the restoration concept. Because in the reformation concept, you say, here's where we are, here's where we need to be, let's move that way. And then you don't abandon your history. And you acknowledge that people near you might possibly actually be saved. The restoration concept says, here's where we are, which is we're nowhere. We don't exist. You know, we don't even have a history. We're not starting from anywhere. All right? You don't admit it that you are. And you say, we're just going to go over there. But you tend to miss the mark. And there are problems with that. Questions, though. I haven't gotten any questions. It's okay. If we don't get any, it's all right. We'll just go move forward. But okay. All right. Another question. What were the three main, four. Actually, I described four branches of the Reformation. Okay, so Lutheranism is one of the branches of the Reformation. Good. Yeah. Yeah, the Reformed movement, which is associated with Zwingli and Calvin. Next. Yeah. Right. The Radical Reformation / Anabaptists. And then the fourth one, the one that we tend to ignore, we prideful, arrogant. Yes.
Calvin?
No. The Catholic Reformation, and it's quite arrogant, I think, on the part of non-Catholics to ignore what was going on in the Catholic Church. Yeah.
Is that also the Methodist?
No, Methodism comes later. As Arminianism was never a significant Christian movement, by the way. Jacob Arminius had no desire, intention, or even thought of starting a religious movement. He was criticizing Calvinism, but there was a fairly small and not terribly significant religious movement, the Remonstrants, and there was the Remonstrant Church in Holland, you would say, or Netherlands. I'm going to talk eventually. In fact, let me just throw it out there, just to kind of we'll attach thoughts to this idea. In my book, I talk about the Second Reformation. And the Second Reformation is the non-magisterial Reformation. And this Reformation is a little bit harder to find. It's a concept I've not seen in the literature as I read it. But to me, I believe there was a sort of a second wave of the Reformation, just like we're going to have a second wave of coronavirus in the fall, except the first wave will never end, so it won't even be a second wave. Whatever. And that was when religious freedom came into play. Because the bottom line is, without religious freedom, you can't have a church of the sort that we, in this room, conceive the church to be. All right? Because if Christianity is not a matter of choice, then what is it? You know, the church is made up of people who've chosen Christ, repented of their sins, and we believe have been baptized into Christ. And so if you have this magisterial situation, then everybody living in Bavaria, well, the Bavarian king, by the way, was Catholic, so everybody in Bavaria was Catholic. And that's just the way it was. And the Church of England, we're not there yet, but the Church of England, which was another sort of branch of the of the Protestant Reformation, in England, you were Anglican. You know, the reason they call it the Anglican Church, it means the English Church, is because everybody in England was part of the Anglican Church. Either that or you get put in jail. All right, so if you don't have freedom of conscience, then how can you really develop the kind of Christianity that we envision what it is, which is a church made out of truly Christian people? So religious freedom came first to Holland. The first place it came to was in Holland, right around the time of Jacob Arminius, actually. And actually, if you're an American and you grew up in America and you learned U.S. history, you know this already. Why do you know? Why do you know? Just think about American history, all right? Why do you know that Holland was where religious freedom first broke out? When you hear the answer, you're going to go, oh, yeah, it's so obvious. Yeah.
Does it have something to do with, like, where our founding fathers got the idea?
No. There's a particular group of people on a particular boat.
The Mayflower.
The Mayflower. Okay. Right. The Mayflower. The Pilgrims. All right, the Pilgrims, what it was is there was this Puritan movement in England, and Puritanism was viciously persecuted in England, and people were martyred. Now, later on, there was the English Revolution, and the Puritans actually took over for a few years and all that stuff. And so where did the Puritans go before they came to America? They went to Holland. All right, and so these were English people that founded Plymouth, all right, and the whole thing, but they actually sailed from Holland because they went there. And so that's the first place where religious freedom was allowed. So in Holland, you had everything. You had Catholics, you had Lutherans, you had Calvinists, and then you had this Brownian church, which is the group from which these pilgrims were technically not Puritans. They were this sort of obscure branch of this Brownian church, which was born the Baptist church. So it's like the pilgrims were kind of pre-Baptists, sort of. It's very confusing. But the cool thing is, it suddenly became confusing, because suddenly you could be whatever you wanted to be. That began first in Holland, then in Rhode Island. All right. And what's his name that founded Rhode Island? You know, come on now, the guy who founded Rhode Island, they were going to hang him there in Boston. And it's in my book. It's in my book, so I should know. No. Well, yeah. Roger Williams. Thank you. Roger Williams was a Baptist. Roger Williams was a Baptist. He's one of the earliest of the Baptists. They didn't call themselves Baptists, by the way. You know what they called themselves? Church of Christ. They called themselves Church of Christ. That's correct. All right, and so Roger Williams brought religious freedom to Rhode Island. All the other colonies, that's the thing is, if you're in Massachusetts, you're a Puritan. If you don't have Puritan, then you don't go to church. There are no other churches. They're all Puritan. If you go to Virginia, you're Anglican. If you don't like it, too bad, because you're Anglican. All right. So there was religious freedom in Rhode Island. And then it was quite a bit later. It's about 50 years later, at least 40 years later, then they got religious freedom in Pennsylvania. Okay. And then across the American colonies, and then in England, and then everywhere. And so in this period, which led to the first Great Awakening, we'll talk about, and later to the second Great Awakening, this is when so many modern religious groups formed, because that's the period that I call the Second Reformation. And it's a little bit harder to nail it down, but essentially it is in the mid to late 1600s through into the 1700s. This is when the Quakers formed. This is when the Methodists formed. Okay, England, by the way, didn't have full religious freedom at that time. But anyway, that's a whole other story. All right, so are we Arminian?
Yes.
Probably, that's, we wouldn't ascribe to everything that Jacob Arminius said, but in a debate, if you're honest, if you have to, if somebody wants to pigeonhole you, yeah, I guess that is essentially what we are. Are we Pelagian? We're probably semi-Pelagian, whatever the heck that means. So we're much closer to Pelagius, certainly, than we are to Augustine, that's for sure. Okay, so which scriptures appear to support the doctrine of predestination? All right, there are a number of them. Remember, the Bible talks about the elect, but it doesn't talk about the reprobate. All right, so let's go to Romans. Romans. Again, this is a church, a class on church history, so it's not a Bible study class, so I don't have time to spend a lot on this, but I want to at least clear things up for us, at least a little bit. All right, let me see, Romans 8. Okay. So we'll say then, blah, blah, blah. Where is it? Yeah, here we go. Verse 28. And we know that in all things God works for the good of those who love him, who've been called according to his purpose. Amen, amen. That's awesome. That's great stuff. Okay, good. It says, for those God foreknew, he also predestined. So who did he predestine? Those he foreknew. Okay, so that's the key to unlocking this door. Okay, and to understand how both sets of scriptures are both true. To be a Calvinist, you have to deny the other set of scriptures or find excuses that look really fishy. All right, and I believe to accept that we have choice, that God gives us that to have some kind of synergism idea, doesn't require that you ignore anything. And in fact, it's eventually it becomes the natural, obvious explanation to all those scriptures. All right. So those he foreknew, he also predestined to be formed to the image of his son, that he might be the firstborn amongst many brothers. And those he predestined, see, that's the problem. It's continuing a long sentence. All right, so how did this sentence start? Those he first foreknew, he predestined. And unfortunately, Paul, in the way he goes, blah, 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 kind of goes off over here. And then, all right, we're back where we started. Those he foreknew, he predestined. And those he predestined, he called. And those he called, he justified. And those he justified, he glorified. All right, now, the Calvinists would say these are all exactly the same group of people. All right, in other words, every single person that he predestines, he calls. And every single person he calls, he justifies. And every single person he justifies, he glorifies. That's perseverance of the saints, or once saved, always saved. But I believe that God predestined everybody for salvation. All right? That's the only explanation that makes sense. Jesus died for the sins of who? The whole world. God's desire is for who to be saved? Everybody. That is God's will. Is God's will always done?
No.
Of course not. Is it God's will that, somebody rapes somebody? That's ridiculous. And yet, according to Calvinism, the answer to that question is yes, that was his will. Not that that's what he wanted to happen, but in the general sense, that's his will. But Jesus said we should pray that God's will would be done on earth as it is in heaven. It is done in heaven, but it's not always done on earth. In fact, maybe it's not always done in heaven. That's a whole other theological discussion. Okay, so anyway, are there scriptures that talk about predestination? Yeah. I mean, but that predestination was about giving everybody the opportunity for salvation. So if he jerks around Pharaoh a little bit in order to, you know, harden his heart, which was the direction he was going anyway, and Pharaoh could have repented, Pharaoh could have ended up in heaven. If he jerks around Judas in a way, kind of, sort of, you know, what you do, do it quickly. Kind of, let's, all right, let's, time now, go for it. All right, but that was bringing about God's will. The God's will was that the Jews would be freed from Egypt in a particular way, which was a foreshadow of how we're freed, and the whole Passover lamb and all the incredible, amazing prefiguring. Jesus, Matthew 5:17, I'm the fulfillment of all these things. All right, so God's predestination was so that everybody could be saved. That's his predestination. But what's his foreknowledge say? Right, he knows who's going to and who's not going to. Now, that'll give you a headache. I admit that will give you a headache, but God is not us. God, if I understand God correctly, you know, time is like this, right? Time is like this. We're here, so there's future and past. If I understand it correctly, God sees the whole thing at once. There's many scriptures that say that. I know the thing that happens before, you know, all that kind of stuff. So God knows, but he doesn't predetermine. And if you want to delve the logic of that, you know, you're probably going to end up having a headache or something like that. I perfectly acknowledge that. It's a mystery, though. When you go into the New Testament, you talk about salvation, you talk about God, and you talk about these things. It's a mystery how these things could all simultaneously be true. So, you know, with that which was formed, tell them, one who formed it, what to do? No, don't try to do that. Trust God's wisdom. In fact, just read the whole book of Romans. He's saying to the Jews, you know, if my plan is to bring in the Gentiles so as to make the Jews jealous and more Jews come in the end, but not right, what now? What are you to argue with me about that? Do you think you know better than me? That's why God is so angry in Romans chapter 9. The Jews are trying to tell God what to do. And when you try to tell God what to do, in a prideful way, God's not going to react very well to that. So that's why he says some, you know, almost mean-sounding stuff in Romans 9. Okay, got it? So, you know, but it says here that who shall separate us from the love of God in Christ Jesus? Neither persecution or famine or nakedness or sword. I mean, nothing in all creation can separate us from the love of God in Christ Jesus, right? Oh, except one thing that he doesn't mention. Ourselves. Okay, we can walk away. So this passage, which can be used to prove predestination, is that's not what it's saying. And also, Jesus says, no one can snatch them out of my hand, correct? True, we acknowledge that. That doesn't mean that we can't leave his hand. I mean, read the book of Hebrews. I once read a commentary by a hardcore Calvinist on the book of Hebrews. And he spends almost half his time explaining why Hebrews is not saying what it's saying. I mean, why did Hebrews even get written? If the pea and tulip is true, then what the heck is Hebrews about? You know, perseverance of the saints. He's saying you better persevere, which means you need to choose to persevere, because if you don't persevere, you won't persevere. You know, you could lose your salvation. All right, so that's my very quick version. Like I said, this is not a sermon and it's not a Bible class, but I think that's what we're talking about. So that's why we're going to go with Arminius pretty much. And there you go. All right. So I'm not covering the English Protestant Reformation. It was a much more gradual thing, and there was a lot of politics involved there with Henry VIII and then the Restoration and Bloody Mary and Queen Elizabeth and the fact that the Queen of England was the head of the English Church, which was sort of interesting back then, and the creation of the Puritan movement in England, which was essentially a back-to-the-Bible movement. The Puritan movement was another Restorationist movement. But it was done within the English church. For the first 30 or 40 years, the Puritans weren't even thinking, other than a very, very tiny minority, weren't even thinking of leaving the Anglican church. They were trying to make the Anglican church more Calvinist. All right, and but also more biblical. All right, so the Puritans. Okay, around 1600, many English Protestants were extremely impatient. The English Protestant Reformation created the Anglican Church. I grew up in the Episcopalian Church, which is essentially the American branch of the Anglican Church. But, of course, the head of the Anglican Church is the king. So, you know, we have this little rebellion against the king over here in America. And so at some point, having the king as the head of our church when we rebelled against the king became a problem. So we formed the Episcopalian Church. When I say we, my great-great-great-great-whatever-great-grandfather was Bishop Seabury, the founding bishop of the Episcopalian Church. So anyway, but the Anglican Church was much more Catholic. And I described the Episcopalian Church, with apologies to all Episcopalians, I'm sorry, but this, I'm still saying it. It's the Catholic without the Pope, all right? Now, as far as the practice goes, the Episcopalian Church is Catholic without the Pope. But ultimately, because of the English Revolution, the theology of the Anglican Church is essentially Calvinist. It's complicated. It's complicated. So if Episcopalians aren't, they're not Calvinist at all, but their church is. It's kind of weird. So the Puritans, they eventually had this little revolution, and you know, they heard about the English Revolution, and the Puritans, who were congregationalist in their idea, all right? So remember, you could have a pope, you could have bishops, you could have elders, Presbyterian church, or you can have congregationalists. And we are congregationalists, by the way. We are congregationalists. We do have elders. You can be a congregationalist and have elders, but basically if you believe in local autonomy, a significant degree of local autonomy, then you are a congregationalist. Okay, now for a few years we moved in a really radically different direction, radically different. And we kind of were like almost Pope-like, but we've gone back to our Restoration roots, so we are congregationalists. The Restoration movement, Stone Camp movement, is also congregationalist. So anyway, the Puritans were congregationalists. Why? Because the church they were supposed to be part of was Episcopalian. It was according to bishops. So anyway, there were the Brownists, named after this guy Brown, who became eventually kind of evolved into the Baptists. A very, very brief history of the Baptists. The Baptists were sort of a grassroots restorationist movement. They, in many ways, they were very, very similar to the Anabaptists. They restored baptism of adults by immersion upon faith, as the Baptists did. But the thing is, like I said, the Anabaptists had been labeled as this crazy, wacko, terrorist group due to this... All right. Due to this, whoever has their microphone on, could you turn it off, please? Hmm? It's probably, yeah, maybe. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. Wherever it is. Thank you. Anyway, where was I? Yeah. So there are a number of these restorationist type movements, of which a branch of the Hussites was that. The Anabaptists were that. But the early Baptist movement were almost identical in philosophy and everything with the Anabaptists. But they as a restoration movement, they wanted to say they have no history. And the closest group there is to having no history probably would have been those early Baptists. But anyway, the Anabaptist label was associated with everything evil in Christianity. So they disavowed their connection to the Anabaptists. Anyway, in this Baptist movement, we're talking about the very, very early 1600s. So this is kind of like the first wave of what I would call the Second Reformation, where we're establishing that Christianity is based on individual conscience, and membership in the Christian church is based on an individual choice to agree with what's going on in that situation. So anyway, there were two branches almost from the very beginning. The very first Baptists were general Baptists. And general Baptists are a belief that the limited atonement? The general Baptists believe in general atonement. Okay? General Baptists, general atonement. And if you reject the general atonement, logically you reject the entire Calvinist system. So the general Baptists were Arminian, essentially. And then you had the particular Baptists, all right? And the particular Baptists fully accepted all the Calvinist thing. Now, this happened because this was organic. The Baptist movement is one of the strangest Christian movements in history because there's no person. There's just no person. You can't say this person founded the Baptist church. There's one guy, his last name is Brown, but he died almost right away. It just sort of happened. It's very interesting. But anyway, by the 1640s or 50s, the particular Baptists and the general Baptists were even sort of mixed within the congregations. But by around the mid-1600s, there was a clear separation, and they had two separate creeds. Both groups had creeds, all right? And so the particular Baptists believe that that atonement was particular. That would be the L, limited atonement, particular atonement. All right, so anyway, generally in England, the general Baptists were dominant, although the numbers were pretty close, well into the 1700s. And this is at the same time the Quaker Church was started in England. There are all these dissenters. In England, you had all these dissenters. It was all Anglican or dissenter. And dissenters couldn't hold political power. They couldn't go to Oxford or Cambridge or all that sort of stuff. They formed their own universities. Because by the end of the 1600s, England also had religious freedom. Anyway, so you got the Baptists, you got the general Baptists, the particular Baptists. Roger Williams was a general Baptist. And in general, I keep using the word general in two different ways, forgive me, but in general, the North was mostly general Baptists. And in general, the South generally was particular Baptists. And there's a reason for that. What is the South of America famous for that Calvinism would be much more friendly to than Arminianism? Slavery. Right. And so in a political environment where slavery has to be explained and supported from the pulpit, which it was, all right, then Calvinism is a much preferable version. So in America, particular Baptist is almost all the Baptists. Yes?
So the North was particular, South was
particular. No, okay, yeah. Again, think about it. Forgive me for trying to do this to you, but think about it logically. All right, Calvinism, the whole idea that it's all predestined.
Yeah.
You know, you have elect and reprobate. Oh. They're a bunch of reprobates, so it's not a problem.
Slavery.
All right, yes, yeah, slavery. All right, so I don't have numbers, but I'm fairly confident that over 90% of Baptists in America are of a particular Baptist thing, maybe even more than 97%. I don't know the numbers. In England, there's generally, when you hear the term English Baptist, that's probably a reference to a general Baptist. So if we were to get in a discussion, if we were kind of have a conference and we bring a bunch of English Baptists, we go, what do we disagree on? Like practically nothing. Right? So we could easily fellowship, easily, and accept as members people from English Baptist. But, you know, but then again, what happened was England got colonized by Baptists for America eventually. And so and sort of particular Baptism was brought back in England, primarily from America. Anyway, I'm spending too much time on that. Okay, so we have the Puritans, which were staunchly Presbyterian. And if you want to understand the history of Christianity in America, you have to understand the Puritans. All right? You have to, you know, which eventually became the Congregationalist Church, which is now it's just a liberal, you know, it's nothing going on there. All right, so we have the Puritans, we have the Baptists. In the year 1700 in England, there were 130 particular Baptists and 115 general Baptist churches in England. Eventually, in England, the general Baptists were the largest group. It mentions, here we go, Roger Williams came to Rhode Island in 1636, the first example of religious tolerance in America. Then there's the Quakers. The Quakers are really interesting. They were a very large movement in England. So we have all these dissenting groups in England, which would include the Baptists, which would include the Puritans, which would include the Quakers. And if you want to understand all branches of Christianity, you got it covered here, you know, pretty much. So between Anglican, and by the way, there were still Catholics. They were kind of hidden. So if you throw in Anglicans, Catholics, Quakers, Puritans, and Baptists, you got every base covered right there. You know? So the Quakers represent the pietist movement. They represent the movement towards emotion, towards personal relationship with God, towards emphasis on the Holy Spirit, and towards emphasis on experiential Christianity. And the idea of having your conversion be the moment of some sort of a experience, some sort of a conversion feeling, which became an accepted and assumed part of Protestant Christianity in general. This idea that you have to have a conversion experience, all right, which is huge in understanding the formation of the whole evangelical movement. So the Quakers, this is a Christian group that has no doctrine. They couldn't care less about doctrine. Now, if you were to sit a George Fox down and ask him, all right, Mr. Fox, I mean, what do you actually believe? His beliefs would have been fairly orthodox. He was not, but he didn't care about that stuff. He wanted people to know Christ and to have a Christian experience. All right? And he grew up in the Puritan church. The Puritan church is just, the Puritan church is up here. It's all up here. It's all in the head and almost nothing in the heart. And so he swings the pendulum, right? What else is new? It's all in the heart and there's nothing left in the head. He formed the Children of Light. They called themselves Friends. They didn't call it church. They called them Quakers because they would do this. The Quakers don't admit it. That's why they called them Quakers, because they were quaking. They had this excuse. But trust me, it's because they were doing this. They're kind of like the equivalent of charismatics, if you will, at that time. Okay? And by the way, it's not an accident that the charismatics, that the Pentecostal church came from Methodism, because that's all part of this pietism movement within Christianity. So then we have the German pietists, which was the equivalent of that. And from the German pietists came the Moravian church. All right? And it gets a little bit complicated, but the Moravian church was the first Protestant church to actually evangelize. You know, when we think about how was Christianity spread around the world, who spread Christianity everywhere around the world? Who did it? The answer is the Catholics did it. It wasn't the Protestants. The Protestants might have moved there and stayed Protestant, but they did almost nothing to evangelize the native populations. All right? So if you want to talk about evangelism in the 16th, 17th century, we're talking about the Catholics and their efforts, their sacrifice to bring Christianity all around the world is epic, folks. In the meantime, the Protestants were arguing amongst themselves about a bunch of waste of time stuff. And the first real evangelistic efforts to come from the Protestant movement was from the Moravians, all right, which was from Nicholas Zinzendorf. Sorry, I don't have slides on this. I might. I don't think so. Do I? Maybe. No, I don't. Okay, I don't have any slides in any of this stuff. I need to add these slides to this PowerPoint. So we have Philip Spener. He's a Lutheran pietist. He said, it is not enough that we hear the word with our outward ear, but we must let it penetrate to our heart so we may hear the Holy Spirit speak there. This is the essence of pietism. So these are sometimes called holiness movements. And the Quakers were like a holiness movement, an experiential Christianity movement. And I'm telling you, if there is ever a Christian movement that was not an experiential movement, it's the Stone Temple movement. We are totally not that. We're so opposite of that as could possibly be. The genesis of our movement was extremely intellectual. Although Barton Stone was a bit of a pietist, that's kind of ironic. All right, we have these people. They started Bible groups. They call them Collegium Philobiblicum. They were known as Bible lovers. That's what their enemies called them. They called them Bible lovers. I think they said, "Oh, thank you so much." These are the German pietists, out of which came this guy Nicholas Zinzendorf. Nicholas Zinzendorf, who founded the Moravian Church. And the Moravians, they were always small. They were only probably in the tens of thousands, but they sent out hundreds and hundreds of evangelists to India, to the Caribbean, to Greenland, to Africa, to all over the world. And the first Protestant group to really take a massive commitment to evangelizing the world. And when Alexander Campbell had his sort of moment, he was strongly influenced by these Moravians. And also, we'll find out, John Wesley, who started the greatest pietist movement in all history, the Wesleyan/Methodist movement, he also was highly influenced by this guy Zinzendorf in this tiny, tiny group of Moravians. I'm now just freelancing. I'm not even looking at my notes here. But there's this famous voyage that John Wesley took with Charles to Georgia to start a mission work there. And there was no Methodist movement. This was just a few guys who'd been there at Oxford just having their discussions. And they're in this massive storm, and John Wesley is panicking. Oh, no, I'm dying, and blah, blah, blah. And there's a bunch of Moravians on the boat, and they're just singing hymns. And they're like, amen, you know, God's will be done. They were missionaries. And when he showed up in Georgia, he basically associated with the Moravians. And so his conversion experience, and really the entire Methodist movement, probably never would have happened if it were not for these Moravians. Which, by the way, there's this, I'm going to really mess you up here with the history, because when Zinzendorf formed his group, there were a group of brethren who he adopted into his little compound there, and they were Hussites. They were the remnant of the Huss movement. So the remnant of the Huss movement kind of merged with Zinzendorf, this German pietist, and formed the Moravian Church, this tiny, tiny church. That's still around today, by the way. They have around 1 million members, almost all of them in Africa and South America in the mission points. And by the way, again, I've tried it. I've gone to the Quakers' websites, and what is their belief system? What do they believe? They won't even tell you. They don't care. They just don't care about all that stuff. All right, so that's kind of the pietists, which basically, instead of my notes, the German pietists were the German equivalent of the Quakers. All right, that's my way of describing it. Okay, fine. So we have Zinzendorf, who was a German pietist who started this incredible evangelistic movement. The level of sacrifice, something like 80% of their foreign missionaries died on the missionary field. Almost all of them died on the missionary field. And they just kept going anyway. It was incredible. It's a great story. All right, and so now we're back in England, and we're going to get to the Restoration Movement pretty soon. We're setting ourselves up for the Restoration Movement, but we have to talk about the Methodists. So we have John and Charles Wesley and George Whitefield. All right. So George Whitefield and John Wesley were these, they began these revivals. And what we're seeing here is the birth of the evangelical movement. The birth of the evangelical movement is in the 1800s in England and America, both simultaneously. All right. And so you have George Whitefield, who is the Calvinist sort of evangelical guy. And you have his good friend, but sometimes hated enemy, as their relationship was complicated, John Wesley, who was the Arminian version of the same thing. All right? Neither Whitehead nor Wesley wanted to leave the Anglican Church. They wanted to reform the Anglican Church. They were a Reformation, not a Restoration movement. And you're going to find me thinking that's actually a wise thing to try to do. But, you know, whatever. You can do what you want to do. So anyway, so the movement started by John Wesley was wildly successful. In fact, by the 1830s and 40s, the Methodists were easily the largest group in America. America became a Christian country not in the 1700s, but in the 1800s because of the Second Great Awakening. And the chief beneficiaries of the Second Great Awakening were the Methodists, the Baptists, the Presbyterians, and the Restorationists, the Campbellites. All four groups had massive growth to the detriment of Catholic and Anglican and Lutheran and those things. All right. Anyway, so we have John Wesley. He's a Pietist. He was quite similar to Pelagius in ways that, you know, could almost be embarrassing. Okay, he believed in a kind of Christian perfectionism, and even when challenged to stop doing it, he refused to do it. He basically, for all practical purposes, said what Pelagius said, which is, if perfection is possible, then it is mandatory on Christians. But if I be generous to John Wesley and say what he's talking about here is not accidental sin, but it's willful sin. If we do that, I think we can find ourselves thinking that's not so bad. But he was accused, I mean, totally accused of work salvation. I mean, you know, and denying grace and all that stuff. But if you know anything about John Wesley, that is not fair at all. So anyway, John Wesley said on free will, the will of man is by nature free only to evil. Yet every man has a measure of free will restored to him by grace. Natural free will in the present state of mankind, I do not understand. I only assert that there is a measure of free will supernaturally restored to every man, together with that supernatural light which enlightens every man that comes into the world. So this is kind of a version of what we would call prevenient grace. So it accepts that mankind fell, and therefore we have the fleshly nature, which he would argue is not free at all. Well, that's an interesting theological debate. But he would say that God, through his grace, restored to us a measure of free will. So the bottom line is he's an Arminian. And so there's two branches. There always have been two branches to the evangelical movement, the Arminian and the Calvinist. But the Calvinist has dominated. And in America today, it's still dominant. All right, good. So anyway, the Wesleyans stressed personal experience. It became the accepted part of Christianity. You have to have some sort of a religious experience. Because they don't do baptism. They baptize infants. I don't know why they do. Why do they even? I don't get it. How does that fit with their doctrine? If they don't believe in original sin, what the heck are they baptizing babies? You'd have to ask a Methodist to explain that. I don't get it. But anyway, so basically, you pray Jesus into your heart. I mean, they didn't call it pray Jesus into your heart, but you have a religious experience. And John Wesley had this religious experience very famously. And so when we have the first Great Awakening, which is right during this time in America, the idea that you have to have a religious experience to be a Christian. So let's move over to America, where we have the Calvinist branch. And George Whitefield, he comes to America. And he was more popular than Wesley. In America, George Whitefield was much more popular than Wesley initially because he was Calvinist. And America is virtually all Calvinist, all right? Even in the North. I mean, talk about Puritans, talk about Calvinists. Oh, my goodness, the Puritans are... All right, so anyway, so George Whitefield comes, and so, and then we have this person. Oh, we'll finally have something from my PowerPoint. Yes, here we go. I have to get back to that. Yeah, Jonathan Edwards. Oops. Oh, what's Jonathan Edwards. All right, so here, Jonathan Edwards is the most influential theologian in American history. Jonathan Edwards was a Puritan. He preached the famous sermon, A Sinner in the Hands of the Angry God. And so in America, you had this congregationalist approach. So the local leadership decides who's members of the church. And so you, if you wanted to be a member of the church, you had to go before this committee and convince them that you had a genuine religious experience. Saying that you believed in the truths, that didn't help at all. You had to have a religious experience. All right? And these guys were, they were, you know, a sinner in the hands of an angry God. I mean, that you know, hell, fire, and brimstone. Because what they're trying to do, these preachers were trying to induce an emotional religious experience in their members. Or the non-members, for that matter. And so there's two ways to do that. One is by preaching grace, which, by the way, Jonathan Edwards did all the time. Or by preaching, you know, you're going to hell. The flames are licking at your heels. And you know, that's the deal. So the bottom line is church membership in America shrank to, I don't know what it was, like 10%, 20%. But anyway, they had these great revivals, and Jonathan Edwards was the sort of the king of promotion of these revivals. And so George Whitefield comes over, and he has these great revivals. It's kind of like, you know, the whole revival thing. You know, Billy Graham comes in. Well, Billy Graham, he's not coming in anywhere right now, but he sure did before. You know, you have tens of thousands of people coming into a stadium, right? And people, they want to have people have this feeling in their heart and come forward. This is started in America. Also in England, because John Wesley did these things. In England, John Wesley was hugely successful. And George Whitehead was as well. Whitefield was as well. In England, you know, Whitefield and the Calvinists were hugely successful. And, you know, John Wesley was as well. So this is when you're starting to get this we're moving towards this evangelicalism. But the 18th century version is this angry God, this fear, and this highly, highly emotional thing. You've heard about the Salem witch trials. That's given birth in this highly emotional situation. Jonathan Edwards. The first Great Awakening was just a little bubble and a glitch. You know, it led to almost nothing. It had very, very little long-term effect on Christianity. So that's in the 1730s and 40s. That's when we have this Great Awakening, all right, which wasn't really that great. Unlike the Second Great Awakening, which we're going to get to next, which was really great. And it changed history in huge ways. So we have this angry, judgmental, hellfire and brimstone. You can't be a member of the church unless you've gone through a religious experience. You have to get in front of a committee and convince them. And all, you know, the thing with the scarlet letter, you know, all the Hawthorne and all that kind of stuff. All right, that's at least certainly in New England. That was Christianity in New England for sure. All right, so the attendance became very low. And then we hit the 1800s. We hit the 1800s. And now this is when everything is going to start to happen. Okay? So, okay, God's assurance. How am I doing here? 9:15. I'm going to go another 15 minutes or so. All right. So we have the pietist and revivalist movements of John and Charles Wesley. Stressed holiness, piety, personal relationship with God, Arminian and theology. His attempt was not to restore Christianity, but to reform Anglicanism. And he was a total, massive organizer, incredible organizer of churches. and they became known, therefore, as Methodists. They have all these methods, all these prayer methods, and all this, you know, a lot like us. I'm telling you, they're a lot like us. It's just so much like us. They have their Bible study outlines, and they have their, you know, their all these formulas for creating these house groups. And if you read about the Wesley movement, the number of parallels with us are really quite striking. But they're pietists, and Heartsy, we're not. All right, then George Whitehead, same as John Wesley, except very, very Calvinistic and unapologetic about it. Wesley and Whitehead had a lot of conflict, but ultimately they were friends, and they were trying to do the same thing. Then we have Jonathan Edwards. I mentioned that. All right, and so now we're going to head into the 19th century. There's going to be this thing called the Cane Ridge Revival that happened in Cane Ridge in Kentucky, and this was kind of the first wave of this massive reawakening of Christianity in America. All right? The greatest beneficiaries of these were the Baptists and the Methodists. The Baptists had been in America for 150 years, but they were small. The Methodists didn't come to America until the end of the 1700s. They were also small because they'd just gotten here. But I want to give a little bit of the background here. Now, this is the period of the Enlightenment. And the Enlightenment, that's, you know, in France with all this, the Age of Reason. And we have Descartes, and we have Francis Bacon, and empiricism, and rationalism, and deism. This sort of rationalistic Christianity. The deists believe in a rational Bible, a rational Christianity. All right? And a kind of a scientific Christianity. All right? Can anybody name a really famous deist?
Thomas Jefferson.
Another really famous deist. James Madison. Another famous deist. Benjamin Franklin. So these guys were children of the Enlightenment. When they say we hold these truths to be self-evident, all people, we're created equal, people, well, all guys who are white and own land are equal. But whatever, let's not worry about that. We'll agree with the spirit of what they're trying to do, even if not the fact. But this was Enlightenment kind of Christianity. All right, so if you believe in a rational Christianity, what are some aspects of Christianity you might downplay? The Holy Spirit, for sure. And certainly the miraculous. And like, say, for example, the resurrection. maybe the atonement, a penal substitutionary atonement. And so deism had a strong influence. And this was a period when, you know, John Wesley was an outlier at this time, this kind of experiential Christianity. Most Christianity was highly rationalistic, very logical. Okay? And we have John Locke. The two principal philosophical underpinnings of the Restoration movement were Francis Bacon, the empiricist, and John Locke. And they believed in individual rights and individual, you know, life, liberty, and property, not pursuit of happiness. John Locke, life, liberty, and property. All right? And Jefferson and Franklin, life, liberty, and happiness. Okay, got it? All right, so now we're coming to America. It's 1801. All right, and we have the Cane Ridge Revival. And this was a revival. One of the ministers there in Cane Ridge was Barton W. Stone. And that's the same Stone of Stone Campbell movement. So what happened was they began these series of revival meetings, but these revival meetings were non-denominational. The revival meetings in the First Great Awakening, which wasn't even that great, were highly, sectarian. I mean, America was very, very sectarian at this time. I mean, the different groups would fight with each other like cats and dogs. So anyway, so you have this thing where tens of thousands of people, this is in the frontier. In 1801, the frontier was like Ohio and Kentucky and Tennessee. This was the frontier, folks. All right, and even Western New York. So anyway, so tens of thousands of people come to this Cane Ridge Revival, and they just start preaching Jesus and just the Bible. And you know, the Presbyterians would speak, Methodists would speak, Baptists would speak, and every kind of Christian would speak, you know. And it was very much charismatic. You had people barking at trees and rolling around, and this was like this. It's kind of similar to the initiation of the charismatic movement, the Pentecostal movement in the early 20th century, is this early 19th century phenomena in the frontier. But in the frontier of America, there were very few established churches. It was the wild, wild west. And, you know, almost nobody went to church, and it was all kind of, America was this incredible individualistic thing. America's always been extremely individualistic. So it's kind of this idea that every person decides for themselves what they believe. This kind of is born in America. And, of course, it's the genesis of the Stone Campbell movement. All right, so you've got this great awakening happening where people are flocking into the churches. Like I said, I don't have numbers. I don't think anybody has numbers, but I would guess in 1760, church attendance was maybe 10%. It might have been more. I don't know numbers. It was certainly less than 20%. And I'm telling you, it was not a very Christian place. And even the founders of our founding documents in our country were deists, who are Christian, I guess. They believed in Jesus as a great teacher, and Christianity is the only rational system and all that. They weren't atheists. They were deists, but anyway. So we have the Cane Ridge Revival. All right, so influences in the Restoration Movement. All right, let's break today's teaching down into three chunks. So I'm going to, instead of doing an hour 15-minute chunk, I'm going to do an hour and 5-minute chunk. So let's stop there. Okay.